Good evening, everyone. Let's take our Bibles. Let's turn to 1 Samuel, the book of 1 Samuel. And we'll pick up some reading in chapter 24, 1 Samuel 24. I'll tell you, the focus of some points I'd like to make this evening has to do with the anointed. Now, as we begin the discussion tonight, or our consideration, we're talking about Saul. He is the anointed of God. But as we've been going through our daily Bible reading here the last couple of weeks, we've read a lot about the conflict, really, between David and Saul. And some things for us to think about here as we kind of just review some of the chapters that we've read over a week ago to bring us up to date. And some points to be made there. We're reminded that David had two opportunities recorded for us here to kill Saul. And both times he refused to kill his arch enemy. I mean, Saul was really his arch enemy, or to allow his men to do so. And you have to wonder why and ask the question why. And these accounts we read reveal something, some things that we need to learn about anger, and about revenge and pride, and on the other side, humility and submission to the Lord's will. Some very powerful lessons here taught against a background of violence. So David was hiding in the wilderness of En-Gedi. And he wound up there, and a couple of weeks ago we talked about that, and we looked at the map and some pictures of just that area of En-Gedi. And we have a picture in our mind of where David was at. And Saul came very close to capturing David, only to be called away to defend the Israelite cities against the invading Philistines. But now Saul has come back again, as we come into the story again. Saul is back, and he has an army of 3,000. I mean, he's pretty intent on finding David and doing something when he finds him. I mean, he's got an army of 3,000. David has about 600 with him. And so Saul has learned from his spies that David is hiding out in the Judean desert and the rocky fortresses there. We looked at some pictures of the mountainous area there and the caves that were just kind of scattered just throughout, and En-Gedi and some of the other places there in the Judean wilderness. And so that's where he's kind of hiding out. But it was there, even, that David had an opportunity to kill Saul. And he spared his life, though. In 1 Samuel chapter 24, beginning in verse 3, Saul came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. And David and his men were far back in the cave, and the men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands, and you will, for you to deal with as you wish.'" Verses 3 and part of verse 4 there. Well, I'm not really sure exactly what prophecy they're referring to. Perhaps there was a prophecy about this that's not recorded here for us. But it seems to be known by David's men. At least that's what they're saying. And David's band is completely silent as David creeps up to where Saul is perhaps resting now and in the privacy of this cool cave. There's 3,000 men on the outside of Saul's army. In many ways, David's very vulnerable right now. In verse 4, latter part of verse 4 says, David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. You know, David's action right here has considerable significance. I mean, taking a portion of a royal robe could have been interpreted in some different ways. One way in particular was that it could have been interpreted as a transition of power, that David was usurping power over Saul. And I suspect that that's one reason why David was so conscience stricken. In doing this against Saul, as though he was trying to steal away the kingdom from Saul. Now, let's remember, keep in mind, God has already anointed David to be the next king. David knows that. He's not forgotten that. But David is of the mind that he is not the one to take Saul out of the position that God has anointed him to serve in. And so David feels bad about having been so close to Saul and cutting off a corner of his royal robe in this way, and has to explain to his men who are bent on killing Saul when they have a chance that, no, we're not going to do that. I mean, many of them were under Saul's death sentence just like David was. If Saul was going to come and kill David, he was going to kill David's men too. So in a very real way, they are wanting to kill Saul, you know, in that way. In verse 6, we read again. And David said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lift my hand against him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." And with these words, David rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went on his way. Can you imagine what David's men are thinking? I mean, his enemy was here. This was an easy kill. I mean, they could have rid themselves of all that Saul now represented. He represents something different now than when he was anointed by God, you know, to be king. And so David could have easily killed Saul, he and his 600 men would have had to face the 3,000 men of Saul on the outside, but those troops would have been leaderless. Many of them even knowing and understanding that David was going to be the next king, that he had been anointed to be king, and David perhaps even led some of those men when he was one of the generals of Saul. It wasn't like they didn't know each other. But still, none of that's really the point. The point is, David was not going to kill Saul, God's anointed. This is the point that we've got to understand and take from this. You know, could David have got away with killing Saul and claiming the throne? Well, I suspect so. I suspect he could have done that. You know, from a strategic standpoint, David needed to do away with Saul. From strictly a strategic standpoint, you know, the longer he waited, the greater chance that Saul could catch up to him and kill David and his men. From a moral standpoint, there was no good reason for Saul trying to kill David. It was Saul who was morally off base. What Saul was trying to do was wrong. And many would have said, David had the right. David didn't start this fight. Saul did. David had the right to kill Saul. So you try to look at it through man's eyes, and we can see surely there was justification where David could have killed Saul. That's not the way David is looking at this. David saw Saul as God's anointed. That's what drives the decisions that David is making. And so David's refusal to attack Saul wasn't based on strategic or moral grounds or reasoning. It was based on the profound respect that David had for Jehovah God, the fear of the Lord. God, David reasoned, had put Paul into kingship. It was God who put Saul there. And for David, rebellion against Saul was equivalent to rebellion against God. That was the way he viewed that. And so that's the real reason why David was unwilling to kill Saul. And David is not only unwilling to kill Saul, but he gives him support. That's harder even to understand. That had to be very hard even for David to do. And as we said before, David already knows that he has been anointed by God to be the next king. Remember back in chapter 16, a couple of weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago in our reading, David knows that he is the one who has been anointed by God to be the next king. But still, he's not willing to kill Saul. So again, David declares his loyalty to Saul, there again in chapter 24. And David waits to confront Saul until the king and his bodyguards are some distance away. And David falls out before the king, and he waves the piece of the king's robe and indicates that he could have killed Saul except for his own conviction. Verse 10, I will not lift my hand against my master because he is the Lord's anointed. David's consistent in the way he's thinking about this and the way he views this. That doesn't mean that David is a wallflower. He's not just standing back. David's not silent about some things that's going on, because he publicly accuses Saul of wrongdoing, you know, against him, trying to kill an innocent man, and he continues to call upon Jehovah's justice to prevail. So it's not like David is not doing anything to change the circumstances. He is. Chapter 24 and verse 12. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evil doers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you. It would seem that the point of the proverb that he quotes was that David was not going to be a doer of evil deeds. And David is approaching this not as a general in an army, but he's approaching this from the standpoint of Saul is God's anointed. And he was not trying to match Saul, evil for evil, because he thought that killing God's anointed would be an evil deed. So David did not believe that he was in the position of judging the one that God had anointed. And David continues in the text in chapter 24, maybe in a little bit of a sarcastic way, in verse 14. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? And what David is saying, what is your purpose? Who am I? What danger am I to you? You know, and you are the king. I'm nothing but like a dog, a dead dog at that. I'm nothing more than like a flea. Why are you trying to kill me? David says something similar to that again in chapter 26 when he takes Saul's spear and his water jug. You know, again, when he had opportunity to kill Saul. And you think about, you know, those things, the spear and the water jug, again, it was to prove that he was there. He was so close, he could have easily had killed Saul. But he didn't. David closes his case with an appeal to God's justice, verse 15. May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand. This being a powerful statement, David's not saying that Saul should not be removed from kingship. He's just saying, I'm not going to make the decision when that happens. David knows it's going to happen. He's already been anointed by God to be king. He knows it's going to happen. But he is saying he's not the one who is going to determine when that happens, but that God will have to do that. A little bit of a side note, a side trip. This principle of lifting one's hand against the Lord's anointed, as David has said, extends beyond an appointed king, I believe, to other servants of God. There are others that God has put in place and position throughout the Bible story to be his spokesman, you know, to be the ones who act on his behalf. They're not anointed as a king was anointed. You know, you think about men like Moses. Think about all the prophets you know, that served in a position of authority on behalf of God. You know, you think about how God warned Abimelech, the king of Gerar, not to harm Abraham, you know, years before this takes place here. How he warned Laban not to harm Jacob. You know, the psalmist, I think, even refers, David refers to these warnings in Psalm 105, do not touch my anointed ones. Do my prophets no harm. God is serious that when he puts people in position to do his work, that God is the one that chose him. Woe to him who gets in the way of God's desires. And so you think, you fast forward even beyond our story here to the days of Jesus and Jesus sending out the 12. And you think about some things that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10 about what the 12 were to do. He who receives you receives me. And anyone who receives a prophet because he is a prophet will receive a prophet's reward. Remember some of the things that Jesus said? You know, in what he was trying to tell his disciples then, or the apostles then, was that you are going as my spokesman. And it's not good for those who reject what you are saying or who reject you. Because he's saying to them, in essence, you are my anointed. You are the ones that I'm sending out. And I mean, these are some things we just need to think about some when we consider the prophets of old and the things they have said, the apostles and the things that their work, the things they have said and written for us. Now, we cannot reject them today physically. They're not here among us. But we think about their work and what they said. And when we reject what they have said on behalf of God, who are we rejecting? God. That's what David was saying long ago. That's why David would not kill Saul. It's because Saul was God's anointed. Jesus' disciples and servants today, us, I think we can be called to account for this, on this too. And the parallel that I would make today is that when you think about elders in a church, those who are appointed for a position, and I view it as appointed by God. I mean, it's a church who has to decide men that they have confidence in who are qualified by God's qualifications to serve in such a way. And I've seen this happen. When someone stands up against an elder in the Lord's church and makes accusations or causes problems or difficulties, think about what they are doing. I mean, why do we think, you know, Paul wrote concerning elders such things as the elders who direct the affairs of the church well are worthy of double honor, especially those whose work is preaching and teaching? He goes on to say, do not entertain an accusation against an elder unless it is brought by two or three witnesses. Those who sin are to be rebuked publicly so that the others may take warning. 1 Timothy 5, verses 17 through 20. That's a powerful statement. But it is not unlike what God said in times of old. When God makes appointments of those who are his spokesmen, those who have right of rule in some way, God's real serious about that. And we need to be serious about understanding that we are not in the position of standing up against them. That's what David is saying. This is the significance of what David is saying of the long ago. Now, we fast forward again to our reading here of the last week. And we go to 2 Samuel chapter 1. 2 Samuel chapter 1. And so as we go from 1 Samuel to 2 Samuel, sometimes you go from one book to another. There's a it's a different storyline. You know, there's different people. It's a different time. There can be a time jump. Not in this case. 2 Samuel is just a continuation of the story we left off with in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. The story just continues. And David hears now about Saul's death. Of course, David had nothing to do with that. It was of Saul's own doing, the battle that took place at Mount Gilboa. And it was there in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel that we read about Saul took his own life. In 1 Samuel 31 and in 1 Chronicles chapter 10, there's parallel accounts. It says almost the same thing, just a little bit something added in the 1 Chronicle account on the end. But it's pretty much, almost word for word, the same account of what happened. The battle was fierce on Mount Gilboa, and the Philistines were bearing down upon them. And when the archers, you know, came upon Saul and his sons, they were wounded. It says Saul was wounded, and he knew it was a mortal wound. And he did not want to face his enemy. And when he asked his armor bearer, even, to kill me, his armor bearer was unwilling to do it. Saul took his sword, chapter 31 says, and he fell upon his own sword. He killed himself. There's an interesting event here in 2 Samuel in chapter 1. You know, of what happens when David hears about the battle and about Saul's death. There was an Amalekite who came to David to tell him about it and had arrived from Saul's camp. He had seen what had happened. He came with his clothes torn and dust on his head, and he came to David, it says in verse 2, and fell down on the ground to pay respect and honor to David. Verse 3, "Where have you come from?" David asked him. And he answered, "I have escaped from the Israelite camp." "What happened?" David said. "Tell me." And he said, "The men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died. Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." Remember how close David was to Jonathan. Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" "I happened to be on Mount Gilboa," the young man said, "and there was Saul leaning on his spear with his chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, and I said, 'What can I do?' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' 'An Amalekite,' I answered. And then he said to me, 'Stand over me and kill me. I'm in the throes of death, but I am still alive.' And so I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm and have brought them here to my Lord." Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. And they mourned and they wept and they fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. It's interesting to think that David would mourn for Saul. We can understand him mourning for Jonathan because they were dear friends. It says they mourned for Saul. And I wonder, I'm confident that David mourned for Saul. You wonder about David's army who wanted to kill him all along anyway. You know, what were they thinking? Maybe were they rejoicing inside? Maybe I shouldn't suppose so much. But you wonder. David grieved because this was the Lord's anointed that had been killed. Verse 13. David said to the young man who brought him the report, "Where are you from?" "I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite," he answered. And David asked him, "Why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And then David called one of his men and said, "Go strike him down." And so he struck him down and he died. For David had said to him, "Your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, 'I killed the Lord's anointed.'" Well, what the man had to say that he killed, I mean, he came to David with the crown and with the band and with this report, thinking that maybe he was going to get some reward out of bringing this news, you know, and that he had killed Saul, this enemy of David. That's not David's response at all. And the fact of the matter is, this man did not kill Saul. Saul killed himself. But David didn't know that. But he took credit thinking he was going to get a reward, and he did. He did get a reward, but not what he had anticipated. He had killed the Lord's anointed. So what does this have to do with us? And what other thoughts or applications might we make? Well, there's probably several things we could say, but I'm going to kind of narrow it down. Who is the anointed one that we might be most familiar with? But the Lord. The Lord is addressed as the anointed of God. And you think about these episodes with David and Saul and with others who were anointed by God, others who were the spokesmen of God, like Moses and the prophets and the apostles, and most certainly the Lord. These are the ones chosen by God, appointed or anointed by God. These were God's men. These were God's people. And when I read and I think about these things, I think I don't even know how much mercy could be prayed for the souls of those who have killed God's anointed through the time. It is not a good place to be in if you've killed the Lord's anointed. We're going to Psalms 2. The second psalm, it's a psalm written in view of the Messiah. Psalm 2, remembering that it is God who determines who he or who will be his anointed. Verse 1, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say. Let us throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven laughs, and the Lord scoffs at them. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. It's a messianic view of the one who is anointed by Jehovah God, who is in heaven sitting on high, who is king and ruler above all principalities and powers. And the plea of the psalmist of God to the world is, kings, you better be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. It is the Lord's anointed to whom we must all bow, all of the kings of the earth, because he has been put and placed in position at the right hand of God and rules from heaven above and has power above all principalities and powers, rule and dominion. He is the Lord's anointed. And we think, and we just think back to the time when the Lord's anointed hung on the cross. And there were those in that day long ago who killed him. And I'm just thinking, not a good position to be in. Because God has always been upset with those who kill his anointed. Just another view or perspective of David, what it is to be the anointed of God, and to know that today we can serve the anointed Son and King that God has put into position. That's our place today, is to serve Him. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest He be angry and you be destroyed in your way. For His wrath can flare up at a moment. Blessed are all those who take refuge in Him. And God has given us the means by which we can take refuge in the Son. Have you done that? Have you taken the refuge that is found in Jesus Christ, the Son of God? That is the blessing that we have. We can be a child of God. If you need to respond to the gospel, would you come tonight as we stand and sing?